Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact, and this is part of what we're going to be talking about today.
A large-scale exchange of prisoners between Russia, the U.S., and several other countries is underway.
Yeah, this is amazing. A massive prisoner exchange is announced taking place between Russia and multiple Western countries. We're going to be breaking this down for you, and it is significant, by the way, in more ways than what you think. This is Direct Impact. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do this. Okay, so here we go. There is, without a doubt, a major international story to tell you about that no doubt bodes well, one would think, for the prospect of peace, right? So here's what's going on. We can now confirm across the board, so has everybody else, by the way, that Russia and a number of Western countries, including Germany and the U.S., have agreed to a very complex 24-person, at least, prisoner swap.
Breaking news that NATO member state Turkey has confirmed that a large-scale exchange of prisoners between Russia, the U.S., and several other countries is underway. More than two dozen prisoners are on the list.
Yeah, so this thing, it's an exchange said to include the release of three American citizens imprisoned in Russia, including a Wall Street Journal reporter, former U.S. Marine, a Russian-American radio journalist. The numbers may not be exact at this point, and who knows, they could change, but the understanding is there were some 12 Western prisoners, about 8 or 9 prisoners as well, on the other side that are going to be returned to each of the corresponding countries. Now, this is happening as there are more calls for peace talks between Ukraine, and this is no accident, by the way, more calls for peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. One came earlier this week from the president of Finland. Now even Ukraine's unelected president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is calling for talks. Here's what he has said, by the way. He says that the majority of the world today says that Russia must be represented at the second summit. Otherwise, we will not achieve meaningful results. Since the whole world wants them to be at the table, says Mr. Zelensky, then we cannot be against it. Well, he's been against it the whole time, but it looks like there's a change now. That's important. Also, look at this. Here's U.S. President Joe Biden being asked just a little while ago if this is the beginning of a better relationship with Russians.
Did this improve relations with Russia? Is there any avenue for that after this prisoner exchange deal?
As my sister might say, your lips to God's ears, man.
Your lips to God's ears, seeming hopeful, seeming like he's saying, I want to have better relations with Russia. Meanwhile, here's another one. Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico, he's being brutally honest in his calls for talks to finally end the fighting. He says, quote, it's time to end the, you're going to love this, the lining of the pockets of arms dealers in the Ukraine war.
Tento veľmi otvorene. Ani problém s ukrajinským tranzitom ruskej ropy nemôže zmeniť náš postoj k vojne na Ukrajine. Tu je treba ukončiť okamžitým prímerím a nie ju umelo predlžovať s nereálnym cieľom dostať Rusko na kolená a s reálnym cieľom napchať ešte viac vrecká zbrojárom.
I gotta tell you, man after my own heart, I love it when people tell it like it is. But here's what we need to consider at this point, right? Is this a sign of some kind of rapprochement, you know, between Russia and the West? If there are calls for peace talks from NATO country leaders, as we've just seen, and two sides can agree between the United States and Russia, Washington and Moscow, for some kind of prisoner swap, can they go further? Can they take the next step? Can they sit down and talk and meet and try to come to some substantive decision or agreement on the conflict between Russia and Ukraine? Manila, to you, are we being overly hopeful here? Or do you see some signs that some people might take at, that could mean that there's some kind of arrangement that might be possible in the future?
Well, Rick, I think we should all continue to be hopeful for a future with peace involved. But to me, the way I'm reading this, all signs on the ground point to no. First of all, that soundbite with Joe Biden. At the end of that press conference regarding the large-scale prisoner swap, the largest since the fall of the Soviet Union, by the way, the families of the Americans were also present at his side. At the end of that presser, as he walked away, a reporter shouted out to him and asked if he has spoken to the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, or will he speak with Vladimir Putin? And he returned to the podium and just said no and walked away. Now, as far as the prisoner swap itself, Rick, I've got a much more cynical take on this than you do. If we look back to just earlier this year, January of this year, detained American journalist and independent filmmaker, YouTuber Gonzalo Lira died in a Ukrainian cell.
Yeah.
All by himself, dying slowly for months.
Mm-hmm.
President Biden, nor anybody in his administration, said a single word about Gonzalo Lira, who was a born and raised American citizen, born in Burbank, California, raised out there.
Mm-hmm.
So that is also Adam Schiff's district, by the way. Adam Schiff, of course, one of the chief Russiagate propagators. None of these people, not Schiff, not Biden, nobody said anything about any sort of prisoner swap or trying to bring Gonzalo Lira home, right? There wouldn't have had to be any trade for Gonzalo because of how much the Americans have provided to Ukraine. He could have picked up the phone and said, give me my guy back. But that didn't happen. So when I look at this prisoner swap, I think this was, obviously, we know it's months in the making, this sort of stuff, especially between six or seven different intermediary countries and other directly involved countries such as Germany. This stuff takes months.
You're assuming.
But here's the thing, right?
But that thing with Lira, you just said, you're assuming that countries, no less the United States, could give a crap about any individual citizen's life. And just to be honest, I mean, you know, note to Manila, countries don't care about individual people.
That is my point. That is my whole point. My whole point is he could have done this, and this prisoner swap was disingenuous. And the fact that I think President Biden thought he was going to be taking a victory lap to boost his numbers because he wasn't expecting to get pushed out of the race.
Right.
So I think they were saving this large scale swap as a victory lap. And because it wasn't, you know, it didn't pan out that way for Joe Biden, they had to move forward with it because so many countries were involved. This is completely disingenuous because the whole point that I brought up Gonzalo Lira is to show that countries don't care about individuals. Everybody is
exactly
some sort of bargaining chip, period.
But you know, obviously, I look at the glass as half full and you see it as half empty. You, my dear, are a cynic, as accused, which makes you a which makes you a good journalist, by the way. Let's move to the Olympics. The French Olympics shocks the world again, allowing two biological men to compete against women boxers, and the outcry is global. Just think about this for a minute. They're saying two guys who are biological men can beat the crap out of some woman on live television. Olympic chiefs have sparked outrage by allowing Lin Yuting of Taiwan and Imane Khalif of Algeria, who were both thrown out of last year's World Championships after being deemed biological males, to enter the women's boxing category in Paris. We've got video. Let's put it on. There it is. So that's Khalif right there in the blue, all right? He's wearing the blue. That's him in a previous flight. He's beating the crap out of this female Mexican boxer, who's a highly regarded medal winner up to there. By the way, the female boxer is wearing the dress, in case you didn't know or notice. She said after the fight that she's never, ever been hit so hard. She's still talking about it. I don't know, Manila. How crazy is this? This whole French Olympics has been like one far left messaging expedition, it seems like to me.
Yeah, it was definitely a cringy thing to watch, Rick, when you have we haven't seen the Taiwanese boxer yet, but the Khalif boxer. I don't know whether or not to be, you know, to address Khalif as a male or female, because the boxer has not identified as trans and has not said one thing or the other than saying that this was a conspiracy to keep Algeria out of winning the gold medal, but did not support the reasoning as to why. So it's a little bit cringy when you view what the International Boxing Association, the organizer of the World Championship, said very recently about why Khalif was barred from the games. It was because they did chromosomal tests on the boxers for at least that particular league.
If it talks and like a duck Khalif, and walks like a duck, it's a
Rick,
duck, Manila.
Oh my goodness, Khalif tested with XY chromosome, and females generally have the double X chromosome. And so Khalif is over there beating up on the Italian boxer, and it was just hard to watch. It was a very cringy moment.
If you quack, you're a duck. All right. You're not a bear. You're not a horse. You're a duck.
Know.
And if you are biologically a male, then you are a male. And that's, I'm sorry.
But here's.
Call me crazy. Maybe I'm absolutely nuts.
You're so old school.
Yeah. What a crazy concept that is. When a man is biologically a man and he goes into a ring with a woman, it's a man fighting a woman. Sorry. It's like,
let me add one more layer
ahead.
Of politics to this. The IBA is currently chaired by the Russians at this point in time, and the Olympic Committee said, "Oh well, we don't take their judgment for this," and that, you know, because Russia is basically effectively banned from the Olympics at this point, so we're not gonna go by the rules of what the IBA says. And then, despite presenting facts such as XX and XY chromosome, there have been scientific studies that show the weakest male punch versus the strongest woman punch is 162% greater.
You're right.
The weakest guy, a guy that doesn't exercise versus a top female athlete, his punch is 162% more powerful than that of a woman. So go figure.
If you look at the theme from the opening ceremony. It's that crazy.
There you go.
It's that crazy God guy who just made people different. Isn't that nutty that he made women one way and made I don't know what he was thinking up there when he did that, but I guess we want to say, no, God, you're wrong. The whole thing is crazy. It is absolutely nuts, and it's showing France for what it is, a loony, weird, crazy place with a really nutty leader who is doing everything possible to start World War III. And I'm sorry, but the facts bear it out. Thanks, Manila. We appreciate you. So when we come back, we're going to start focusing on the story that the whole world seems to be talking about as well, and that is this spree of assassinations on the part of Israel, with a particular interest on what's going on with Iran and Hezbollah. We're going to talk to an author who has written specifically on this topic. His name is Bashir Saad, and he's going to be good enough to join us. Stay right there. We'll be right back. We want to talk to somebody now because he's an expert on the people that Bibi Netanyahu hates, wants to kill, and wants to destroy their entire civilization. I mean, I don't think there's a better way for me to explain this. We're going to be joined by somebody who has worked at the University of Stirling. Bashir Saad is also an author who wrote a book, and this is why I think he makes a perfect guest for what we're going to be talking about. His book is called Hezbollah and the Politics of Remembrance. You know, it's interesting, Bashir, because here in the United States and in the West, when we talk about Hezbollah, it's always referred to us as a terrorist organization, a militia group, all kinds of negative connotations. Even with people who try to remain neutral, they still use language that makes it sound like, it's kind of an evil organization. What should we know about Hezbollah that we don't know, especially in the West?
One of the reasons it's portrayed as such is because the West has a painful experience with Hezbollah. Hezbollah is born out of a big confrontation or a destructive confrontation with the Americans in the beginning of the 80s. So I think that's one of the reasons. And there was a taking of hostages, there was a blowing up of the Marine barrack and all that. So in that sense, you're blacklisted. because of that.
Do they deserve that? Do they deserve that? Is that deserving?
I don't think so. No, I mean they're just fighting an occupier on their land. So it depends. I guess it depends from which perspective you see it. But you usually blacklist someone because they don't bend to your political interest. Now you can criticize their political orientation, but also you can try to understand it. So it's just a different political orientation, so, and it doesn't suit the American interests.
So let's go through a series of questions. Number one, are they beholden to the Ayatollah Khomeini and Iran? Do they take orders from Iran?
No, I wouldn't say they take orders from Iran. They're closely aligned with Iran. If anything, it's possible that Iran even needs them to understand more the terrain. It's not. It's more of a symbiotic relation. I would say than a top down relationship. And also just because the Iranians don't think they interfere in the micromanage. Let's call it micromanagement of how the resistance works. The actual organization work, but they are aligned because they have similar orientation.
So it's no different. So the way you describe it, then it's no different than the British and the Americans and the French are allies. That doesn't mean because one does something, the other one is behind it.
Yeah. For example, even though here it's not really two states, it's an organization that exists within a country, but that has a very complex relationship with that country, and it has a popular base in that country. I wanted to say something, I forgot.
Let me tell you the reason I'm asking you these questions, because it looks like. In the past couple of days, and this is the reason we have you on, we're trying to get into the mind of Bibi Netanyahu, which is probably not an easy thing to do. But he's attacking Beirut, right, to kill people. He's attacking Iran to kill people. Iraq, I believe it was it Libya or where else did he? Syria, pardon me. He also attacked. So I think in the mind of Bibi Netanyahu, and I'm trying to get in his head to try to understand what he's doing, he sees all of these places and all of these countries as a network that he has to destroy. Is he right? Is he wrong? And why?
I mean, these countries contain groups that are aligned and that have anti-Israeli or anti-Zionist agendas. That's true. The problem is the way the Israelis do it is that they act punitively because militarily they can't do much anymore. So the only way for them to act is to just, you know, try to kill leaders, do sensational stuff like that. So it's like maximum impact in terms of emotional impact and all that. But in terms of military maneuvering, it's completely obsolete.
Why?
It just affects the morale.
I'm confused. You just said, and I'm kind of a little bit surprised by what you said, militarily. Mm. They no longer have the same power. What do you mean by that?
Well, because if you look at the long term trend. So Israel, the state Israel, from the 50s, 60s, 70s onwards, the various wars that happened, and you see how they acted on the ground and how it works. In 82, for example, they invaded Lebanon until the capital, like by foot. It was just, they just went in like it's a supermarket. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and even in 2000, they withdrew from the south because they were being fought by Hezbollah mainly. In 2006, they couldn't even go 200 meters into Lebanon. Instead, what they did was they did exactly what they did in Gaza. They just bombed everything they could. They destroyed the infrastructure. They just did punitive strikes. They just tried to affect on that level. But on the ground, they can't do much. I mean, when did you hear of a military battle where Israel has succeeded in, you know, like winning a battle on the ground? It just doesn't exist because they can't do it anymore.
No, you got to think back to Sharon. You're right. You got to think back to Sharon in Lebanon. You got to think back to Egypt, Moshe Adan, You have to think back of the history of the country where they actually can control a theater. You're saying they haven't been able to control a theater in a long time, so they just lob missiles and make a lot of noise.
Exactly. They have air power because they have the technology from, you know, various Western countries. They actually are aided by these Western countries. They can't even do it on their own anymore. Even that, they're doing it with plenty of aid. Since October, there's like millions and billions of, that have been given just to aid and just trying to dislodge a few guys in tunnels and, you know.
Yeah.
And some people at the northern border. Instead, I mean, and meanwhile, Hezbollah is acting militarily, strategically. They're destroying bases, surveillance technology. They're hitting basically at the military level. That's why I'm saying this. And meanwhile, if Israel could, they would have invaded Lebanon a while ago, given what Hezbollah is doing in their northern. In their northern territories.
So let me get back into my Bibi Netanyahu brain. I'm now Bibi Netanyahu, okay. And I'm going to say to you, it doesn't matter that we, don't have that kind of powerful military to occupy and control a theater in a traditional sense, because you know what I got? Mm-hmm. I got the United States of America. In fact, I just went there. I spoke to Congress. I'm more the President of the United States than the President of the United States is. And when I decide that I'm ready for a full-out war, I don't need an Israeli military. I got the U.S. military.
Well, I think the U.S. is, well, we're not really sure what happened in the U.S. and what, I wouldn't know what exactly is the U.S. stance, but I'm pretty sure there's some ceilings that Netanyahu cannot really transgress. So that's why you end up having key leaders killed, because that's really the most you can do in terms of impact, while at the same time not being able to invest yourself militarily much.
Right.
Because I think at the end of the day, like all-out war in the region is something that would not just hurt Israel, but also the U.S. This is what I'm
So you think in the end, from a geopolitical standpoint, when it really came down and the rubber meets the road, so to speak, the U.S. would back off and say, no, look, we're not fighting this war for you. You got yourself into this mess. You get yourself out of this mess, right? You think there?
Look at.
Go ahead.
Look at what the U.S. and Britain and, you know, the alliance of the U.S. basically has done in Yemen. They said they're going to dislodge the Houthis. What happened? They did a few theatrical strikes, and then that's it.
Does it bother you, though? I mean, I don't have to give you the names. You know them, right? All the people who run the State Department, a lot of the people who run, national security for the United States. I mean, they're Zionists. A lot of them are just Zionists. I mean, sometimes I look at these guys and I read their record, and they sound more beholden to Israel than they do to my country. What do you think of that?
I mean, obviously, this is deplorable. It's a very sad state of affairs that I'm born in. I'm born into this life, seeing this. Since, I mean, my parents told me the same. My grandparents. It's the story of our region. There's always been a blatantly pro-Israeli camp in the West, and specifically in the U.S. And the U.S. really led that torch after 67. Before that, the U.S., I guess, wasn't too bothered. If anything, they were not pro-Arab, but they were not that pro-Israeli. It's really after 67, I think, that that kind of synergy took place. I mean, there's great books on that relationship.
You know, it's funny. You and I were talking before we went on the air, and I'm fascinated by this because you make a great point, I think, what you were alluding to, what your parents told you, because if you look at this historically, Arabs, and when I mean Arabs, I mean people from that culture, whether they're Christian or whether they're Muslim, it doesn't matter, have always been very, very close to the Jews. They have great relationships over the years. They never abused them. They always respected them. The people the Jews are now, or the Jewish state, I should say, Israel is now very aligned with, are the people who've treated them horribly over the years. I mean, the Christians, to be honest with you, were the ones who treated the Jews badly. It wasn't the Muslims.
It's one of the saddest story of modern times. The huge propaganda that the Zionist lobby has, you know, unleashed to say that the Jews were persecuted everywhere, especially in the Arab world, and that they should go to this place called Israel. Because the thing is, there was a state colonial project, and how do you make it survive? You have to create national myths.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, the Jews suffered in Europe.
Of course.
And there was a Western, there was a problem in the West about that. But the problem is, it wasn't enough to actually build a state in the Arab world. So what it did was they also expanded that rhetoric with the help of the British and the Germans and others, especially the French, actually, in North Africa, to create that myth that the Jews in these regions also were persecuted. And there's lots of historical, there were lots of historians that wrote about this, that we spend, you know, a lot of effort in the academic community debunking their claims, because they're completely bogus. And yes, that's why in Iran, I don't know if you know this story, you're going to like this story, but in Iran, a few years ago, I think it was at the time Sharon was prime minister, he offered the Jewish, you know, he offered the Jewish community in Iran, I don't remember how much money to actually send the Jews to Israel. And you know, in Iran, the parliament has Jewish representatives in the parliament in Iran. And one of the parliamentary member at the time, it's a famous story, he said, no, thank you, we're very happy in Iran, we're Iranians, and we're we've always lived here, and we're not going to live in a small military apartheid state, doing some, you know, massive killing all the time.
That's amazing. Well, I'll tell you, what a wonderful conversation, Bashir Saad. The book is called Hezbollah and the Politics of Remembrance. Look it up. Smart man, good author, good book. Thank you, sir, for sharing your time with us.
Thank you very much.
That's our show. Remember, always look outside your own box. That's if you're looking for truth, that is, because truths, they don't live in boxes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time.